I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The reviews are in. The Dallas Morning News says Obama knocks it out of the park. London's Guardian called it a thoughtful Nobel lecture. Even Newt Gingrich said it was very good. But Dawn, the Pakistani newspaper, quotes residents furious about U.S. drone attacks who said people are dying because of Obama's policies. President Barack Obama accepted the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, Norway today, only the third sitting American president to receive the award. He said past recipients like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela deserved the prize more than he did. He also tried to reconcile the obvious contradiction of a wartime president who just ordered more troops into Afghanistan accepting a peace prize.
One of these wars is winding down. The other is a conflict that America did not seek, one in which we are joined by 42 other countries, including Norway, in an effort to defend ourselves and all nations from further attacks. Still, we are at war. And I'm responsible for the deployment of thousands of young Americans to battle in a distant land. And some will kill, and some will be killed.
We want to spend a good chunk of time today listening back to the president's speech with Michael Tomasky, editor-at-large of Guardian America. He's in D.C. And, Michael, the speech, just shy of 36 minutes, about 4,000 words, twice as long as Obama's inaugural. The title was A Just and Lasting Peace. How did you think overall he did in sort of squaring, as we said, that idea of receiving a peace award while waging a war?
Well, it's a very complicated argument that he's trying to make, and it was a very complicated speech. I mean, I sometimes felt listening to certain passages that a listener had to have read the collected works of Reinhold Niebuhr to really have a complete appreciation of the thing. I would at least say this. It was deep, and it wasn't merely self-justification. He wasn't standing up there trying to defend his own policies and decisions. He wasn't trying to persuade world opinion, world public opinion, that they should rally behind him in this doubling down in Afghanistan. And interestingly, I mean, he wasn't even playing to an American domestic audience that much either, because there was plenty of stuff in there that the American right, for example, would find to criticize, and I think will over time, despite these initial reactions. It's not his greatest speech, but probably his most interesting in some ways.
Well, and as you say, he had to reach back to a theologian, and actually at one point to the history of war to make his case, talking also about diplomacy, sanctions, but, again, making it very clear that he does believe war is sometimes the answer. Let's listen again.
I face the world as it is and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to the American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Negotiations cannot convince al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism, it is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason.
Michael Tomasky, can you tell how that went over, making the case for evil in the world, again, in front of a peace panel?
Yeah. It was hard to tell. I mean, you could get certain instances when they flashed away to the crowd, and then you could see again at the end when he got a standing ovation. I think a standing ovation is probably more or less obligatory under such circumstances. And as the camera panned, you could see that some people were smiling. Some people had that look on their face as if they had just been deeply moved. And others weren't really smiling. You know, you could tell that he wasn't pandering to them. It was a very interesting and challenging message. And it wasn't like, if you compare it, say, to his race speech, the message of that race speech was a little bit more direct and digestible for the average person.
Well, and you say, on the one hand, there were some in this audience who might not have been happy, meaning people who support peace. But as you also said, he's going to be criticized from the right. He also talked about how he differentiated himself from the Bush administration. And this is the portion of the speech that drew one of two rounds of applause. Let's listen.
I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is a source of our strength. That is why I prohibited torture. That is why I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed. And that is why I have reaffirmed America's commitment to abide by the Geneva Conventions. We lose ourselves when we compromise the very ideals that we fight to defend.
Again, Michael Tomasky, your thoughts on that point in the speech?
Couldn't you hear him maybe waiting for applause after he said a couple of those things, sort of expecting it to come, and then it didn't come, and then he continued on? Some of the silences were a bit pregnant to me. This is one of the things that I sort of admire about this speech. While we might not call it one of these real Obama tub thumpers, I don't think we would call it that, but he did not spoon-feed that audience everything it wanted. He could have carried on a lot longer about torture and been more critical of the previous administration, and it would have gone down much better in that hall, but he chose not to do that. So, I felt it was pretty non-political in a way and intellectually honest.
I want to get to two more points he makes. He talked about basic human rights, economic justice, making sure people have their needs met. Let's listen.
The absence of hope can rot a society from within. And that's why helping farmers feed their own people or nations educate their children and care for the sick is not mere charity. It's also why the world must come together to confront climate change. There's little scientific dispute that if we do nothing, we will face more drought, more famine, more mass displacement, all of which will fuel more conflict for decades.
President Obama speaking today, he also spoke about globalization and faith, religion. Let's listen there.
And most dangerously, we see it in the way that religion is used to justify the murder of innocents by those who have distorted and defiled the great religion of Islam and who attacked my country from Afghanistan. These extremists are not the first to kill in the name of God. The cruelties of the Crusades are amply recorded. But they remind us that no holy war can ever be a just war.
Michael Tomasky, obviously trying to get a message out to other parts of the world there.
Yes, and these are some of the sections of the speech talking about climate change and globalization and poverty, where he was talking to a global audience and was saying things that were more pleasing probably to the crowd in the room. Those things, conversely, would be things that would be somewhat contentious here in the United States. Obviously, climate change is facing an uphill fight, to put it mildly, in the Senate.
Well, and we've been speaking about the irony of this speech, and there's one moment where he put two things together that some would find ironic. He said, somewhere today, a soldier sees he's outgunned but stands firm to keep the peace, a soldier keeping the peace. Somewhere today, a protester awaits the brutality of her government but has the courage to march on. Sort of, again, trying to walk the tightrope between protest to bring peace and war to bring peace.
Yeah, and that echoes what he is trying to do in Afghanistan, too. If you read General McChrystal's proposal, it makes that argument. It says we don't need these troops so we can kill more people. We need these troops so we can pacify the country and win the whole hearts and minds argument.
Michael Tomasky, when President Obama was first nominated, you wrote that he should not travel to Oslo, not accept the award, because he shouldn't collect an award he hadn't yet earned. Do you think, and having heard his speech, that time was well spent?
Yeah, I think it was. I mean, I would still agree with the majority of Americans who think, you know, he didn't deserve it yet. He may someday. In the long run, it's pretty unrealistic to think that a Nobel awardee is going to deny the prize.
It strikes me that he was handed both a war and a peace prize that, you know, he might not have wanted either.
I think it's probably definite that he wanted neither, Robin.
Yeah. Michael Tomasky, editor-at-large of Guardian America. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
My pleasure.
Well, news today. FBI and Pakistani intelligence officials are questioning the five young Muslim Americans arrested in Pakistan yesterday. The father of one was also arrested, and he is believed to be affiliated with a banned Islamic militant group in Pakistan, a group that's linked to the house that the young men in their late teens and early 20s were seized from. All five are from the suburbs of Washington, D.C. They disappeared suddenly last month, prompting their families to seek the help of a local Islamic American advocacy group, which immediately brought in the FBI. None of the men have been accused of any crime. Authorities are still trying to understand their intentions. One of them left behind an 11-minute video, which an official is calling disturbing. Let's find out more about all of this from Josh Meyer. He's national security correspondent for the L.A. Times. Josh, the police chief in Sargodha, where these men were arrested in Pakistan, is quoted as saying they proudly confessed they wanted to join a holy war. But what do we know, you know, from their families or otherwise about why they're there?
Hi, Robin. You know, it's hard to tell in situations like this what's going on, especially this one. It seems very fluid. You often get Pakistani officials saying one thing only to find out that something else is actually happening. But the one thing that we do know, I spoke to some people here that were closely connected to the families, including an official from the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And he said that they saw the video, they were very, very concerned about it, and immediately thought that they needed to contact the FBI and get them involved in the investigation. So the families are working closely with the FBI to figure out what's going on and why these young men decided to suddenly leave the Washington area and go to Pakistan.
And
so there was a lot of concern.
Right, and understand, underscoring that a lot of that concern comes from Muslim groups, including the one that called in the FBI.
Right.
And they've been speaking out strongly against religious violence. You know, what are they saying about the potential of the links to any mosques here or any religious teaching here and these young men?
That's one of the things the FBI is trying to run to ground right now. But I do know that some of the people at the Council on American Islamic Relations and some of these other groups, and I can tell you that, you know, that many of them, most of them, or virtually all of them, are very, very concerned about this and are very eager to try to root out whatever sort of, you know, needles in the haystacks there are in the communities here who might be bad apples, and work with the authorities to try to make sure that they don't, you know, launch any attacks, because it makes them obviously look bad as well, and they're very concerned about that these guys are sort of hijacking the Islamic faith for something that's much more violent.
Well, the families are puzzled. One of the young men is being identified as Rami Zamzan Nomazam, an Egyptian-American, and by all accounts, a serious dental student at Howard University.
Yeah, I looked at his Facebook page. He seems like a very serious young man. He seems very politically active, but not in any sort of violent sort of way. So, again, it's hard to tell, you know, what exactly is motivating these guys, if anything. I mean, one of the Pakistani-Americans who was arrested in over there, now it turns out was arrested with his father, who the local Pakistani papers are saying was connected to a group called Jaish-e-Mohammed, which is a very dangerous militant group. But, you know, the mother says that they were over there because the son was getting married. So, you know, I think a lot of that's going to have to shake out in the investigation.
Yeah. Josh Meyer in Washington, D.C., national security correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. It's interesting. It's on the day that President Obama receives his Nobel Peace Prize and makes the case that we still have to be concerned about dangers. We hear of five young Americans arrested in Pakistan in a house linked to militants in Pakistan. Josh, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, just ahead, we'll take a minute break and then come back to talk to Christine Brennan and ask, what did sports reporters know and when did they know anything about Tiger Woods' infidelity? That's next. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. A warning, some of the following conversation may not be appropriate for young people. And who would have thought just a few weeks ago that anything having to do with Tiger Woods would not be appropriate for young people? Well, reporter Charlie Pierce might have. You may know Charlie from his sports writing for many outlets or from his role as a panelist on the NPR program Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He wrote a 1997 profile on Tiger Woods that included Tiger's dirty jokes about condoms, musings about black men's sexual prowess, and gay and lesbian sex. Charlie met a 21-year-old Tiger on the brink of winning his first major, but already deified by the press. And as Charlie pointed out, with Tiger's off-color jokes, he was blasphemizing his own image, which, by the way, Charlie thought was a good thing. Who can live up to the hype, he asked. Well, Charlie's article was vilified. Tiger Woods' management company, IMG, accused Charlie of wiretapping, and everyone forgot about it until now. You all know the headlines. We're not going to dig into the dirt, except to say that, as everyone now knows, a number of women, including porn stars and cocktail waitresses, have come forward claiming to have had sexual affairs with Tiger, armed with compromising text messages and emails. Tiger admits transgressions. What we want to ponder for a few minutes is, who else in the media knew that the image so carefully cultivated was not exactly true? Christine Brennan is a sports columnist for USA Today. Christine, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's great to be with you.
Well, we should say Charlie Pierce is not doing any interviews. He says he wants his writing to speak for itself. And in fact, he wrote a new piece in response to his 1997 piece. We'll link our listeners to both at our website, herenow.org. But he says today, one of the worst kept secrets on the tour in 1997 was that Tiger did have a reputation as being, as Charlie said, a hound. And that the image we know now was constructed by IMG and Tiger's sponsors. His caddy, Steve Williams, and IMG would come down hard on anyone who said otherwise. In fact, reporters made a devil's bargain. And if they pointed out Tiger's temper or his unsavory corporate companions, it would mean the end of their access. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, Charlie is a terrific reporter, a good friend. And I believe everything he said and wrote. So there you go. First things first. I'm not only does Charlie stand by his story back in the 90s, but I think most of us stand by it as well in the media that Charlie is a terrific journalist. So, number one, as you may know, I've covered golf as a columnist for USA Today since late 90s, and Tiger really since 1997. So I've been around him for 12 years. I don't know him. I've never shaken his hand. Been at probably triple figures now, Robin, of press conferences with Tiger. And I know that his people, you know, his people read what I do and write and what I say on TV. And maybe they'll even listen in on us here right now. Because I would get calls. Mark Steinberg, the agent, found me at Wimbledon back, I think it was in 01, and he was screaming about a column I wrote, which the Tiger was furious and would never speak to me again. And I reminded Mark, well, Tiger's never spoken to me personally, so it wouldn't be a huge tragedy to me if Tiger never spoke to me again.
What did you say that was so offensive?
You know, I can't even remember. I've been meaning to go back and look up, and I haven't. There was a column I wrote about Tiger's caddy, Steve Williams. Might not have been this one, but I know they were angry with this, that Tiger, his caddy, had taken a camera from an offending cameraman who had clicked in his backswing. Oh, and can you imagine now how they're feeling the last 2 weeks if this is how they micromanaged before?
Well, it would seem as if this careful cocoon, as Charlie and others call it, of protection and this carefully burnished image that IMG in particular created sort of suffocated their golden goose, maybe has killed their golden goose.
Yeah, although Tiger, I think, wanted it desperately. Tiger's a smart guy. He went to Stanford for 2 years, Robin. He could have graduated. I mean, he just turned pro. So this is all of Tiger's making. And, you know, the point with the column was that I said, where would Tiger be without cameras? As Stevie is throwing a poor cameraman's camera in the lake, and that's happened, I think, once or twice, and people might remember that. And, of course, that was a snide and cynical remark, but where would Tiger be without cameras? You know, these offending, terrible cameras. You know, Tiger would be playing golf by himself for no money. So part of it is they want it both ways, and the media that they have used so beautifully, and this is kind of what you're getting at, how they've constructed his image. I didn't know. Believe me, I'd be the first to report it if I'd known some of
this.
That's
the question. Would you have?
Oh, well, it depends. I mean, if the car accident, what happened to the most famous golfer on the planet, the most famous athlete? Sure. As a journalist, doing it journalistically sound as you would, as I would, as all of us who do the things the right way, I'm not a tabloid journalist, don't pay, but sure, if I had the opportunity to start to report on some of this, in today's column I did, I talked to sponsors.
Well, golf.com assembled a panel of writers, sports writers, who are wringing their hands over this, wondering if they missed something, you know, in the run-up to the accident. And, you know, Charlie sort of intimates that, you know, people knew things and didn't say anything because they were afraid of not getting access. Do you think that happened?
Certainly not with me. I don't have access. I may well be, and I don't say this, I'm trying to be as humble as possible here, but I might be the most critical person of Tiger over the last 10 to 12 years. And And I, you know, mostly on social issue questions. What, you know, he wanted it one way, you know, and then he didn't want to make money by talking about social issue, but not talking about it with the South Carolina flag, women at Augusta. Finally, he did. You know, those kinds of things. But I think this, there's not a lot of journalism breaking out in that press tent. And we saw that with the issue of women members of Augusta National. So I'll speak to that issue more. That I was stunned when I raised my hand and asked, do you have any women members here? And if not, why not? Back in 99. That most of my friends, and these are good guys, I dated some of them over the years. I mean, these are wonderful men covering golf, almost all of them men, Robin. They were punching me in the shoulder afterwards and said, oh, man, you're here causing trouble. I said, causing trouble? I asked a simple question that would have been Journalism 101 at Northwestern. So I think that is a window into how what the journalism level is in golf. And I've got to believe they are all just, this is their meal ticket. And if Tiger goes down, maybe so does the interest in golf. This is going to be fascinating to watch.
Christine Brennan, sports columnist for USA Today. We'll watch it with you, Christine. Thanks so much.
Robin, thank you for having me.
Okay. Still ahead today, speaking of deals with the devil, using Faust as a gateway to get young readers into the classics. That's later in the program. The latest news is next, here and now. In April, we told you about the launch off the New Jersey coast of an underwater glider attempting to become the first remote-controlled underwater vehicle to cross the Atlantic. Well, the voyage of the 6-foot, 120-pound robot from Rutgers University called RU-27 has come to an end. Ari Daniel Shapiro from IEEE Spectrum Radio has the story.
The Rutgers University's Coastal Ocean Observation Lab, or Cool Room, was bustling last Thursday at midnight. More than 30 students and scientists pored anxiously over the dozens of monitors coating the walls and tabletops. Maps of the Atlantic Ocean and west coast of Spain filled 6 of the screens. Everyone was waiting to hear the code words that would mark a successful recovery of the underwater glider called RU-27. The bear is in the igloo. Ethan Handel is a technician at Rutgers.
Most of us didn't ever think it was going to happen. You know, the thing is, doesn't have a propeller. It can't really fight strong currents. There's so much out there going against it.
Without a propeller, the glider had to traverse the Atlantic by zigzagging up and down in the upper part of the ocean, moving between the waypoints assigned by the co-pilots.
It's not over yet.
Undergrad David Kaminsky, one of the glider's co-pilots, was nervous. Without a successful recovery, months of work could literally sink to the bottom. That actually happened last year when the same transatlantic mission came to an abrupt halt after a different glider sank off the coast of the Azores.
This is probably one of the most dangerous parts of the mission. Something can always still go wrong until the glider is actually on board of the main vessel out there.
6 time zones and a little more than 3,000 miles away, the vessel Investigador waited 180 miles off the west coast of Spain trying to make that happen. On board, scientists from Rutgers, the University of Las Palmas on the Canary Islands, and the Spanish port system scanned the water for the glider as the ship slowly converged on RU-27's last reported position. Josh Kohut, one of the scientists aboard, called up the cool room using a satellite phone to give his colleagues back in New Jersey a play-by-play of the recovery operation. The seas had been calm most of the night, but at sunrise, the wind kicked up and every wave began to look like the glider. Until...
We have a sighting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice.
Right there.
Right there.
There's a lot of very happy people on board this ship right now.
But back in New Jersey, everyone still looked so worried. They'd found the glider, but it wasn't aboard the recovery ship yet. I looked around the room, watching friends and colleagues hanging out in the middle of the night eating chocolate donuts and bananas, hanging on every word that came out of the speakerphone, kind of like a science slumber party, staying up late for a glider whose adventures had already caused many a sleepless night.
Oh, man, we're so close.
Meanwhile, back off the coast of Spain, a team of scientists maneuvered a small boat called a Zodiac up to the glider, gingerly lifted it aboard, and made their way back to the mothership.
The Zodiac is on the edge of the ship.
And soon, the Zodiac and the glider were safe aboard.
I think we can
Glider co-pilots Shannon Harrison and David Kaminsky said it felt like they'd just won the World Series.
I've never been this awake at 4 o'clock in the morning before in my life.
Ecstatic is probably the best word to use.
As Kaminsky explains, RU-27's voyage across the Atlantic wasn't just a joyride. It's one of a handful of gliders being used all over the world, each one crammed with sensors that measure all sorts of things like chemicals and sediment particles, even ocean water temperature and salinity that can help us understand something about our changing climate.
It's to be able to learn how the Earth works, how the climate works, and how the climate is controlled essentially by the ocean, and that's what we're doing. This glider is out there to try to sample the ocean like no glider ever has before.
And this little glider had made history. RU-27 is the first remote-controlled object ever to cross an ocean underwater, a cause for celebration here in New Jersey and off the coast of Spain, where the glider was wet again. But this time, it was because it had been drenched in champagne.
Gina, I'm going to take your picture.
Ari Daniel Shapiro, a producer for IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. We can take a quick break. Be back in 30 seconds with your letters here and now. In 2007, the BBC's Alan Johnston was kidnapped and held for 4 months in Gaza City. Recently, he returned to the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories for the first time since his release. He found the split between Hamas, which controls Gaza, and Fatah, which controls the West Bank, continues to divide Palestinians. And now there are reports that the rival groups are unlawfully detaining and even torturing each other's supporters. Alan Johnston reports from the West Bank town of Nablus.
Just outside the city of Nablus, the Fatah faithful gather for a party rally. Flags flutter in the sunshine, there are folk dances and fiery speeches, and of course the speakers rage at the Israeli occupation. But they also attack an opponent even closer to home, Hamas. The West Bank is Fatah's stronghold, and being associated with Hamas here now can be very difficult. Hafez Shaheen isn't a party member, but he was elected to Nablus City Council on a list that Hamas backed. Recently, he was arrested at work.
One of them hit me with his hand on my face two or three times, but after that, they did not.
And the first time you were detained, how were you treated then?
The first time was much worse because the first time was a direct reaction of what happened in Gaza.
Tensions in Gaza, there was a reaction here. About a year ago, you were picked up.
So they came here to me at home, at this house, at 1:30 in the night. They pushed me out. They knocked my two sons down. I was taken for 48 hours. Both sons were taken with me. One of them was hit by them the same day, so they were forced to take him to the hospital the same night from the guns on his back.
Rifle butts.
Yeah, it was so bad, so they left him the next day. But the other son, he did stay with them another 2 weeks after that.
Many testimonies like this have been recorded by the Palestinian Independent Commission for Human Rights. Its director is Randa Sinora.
There has been extensive cases during the past 2 years. We can say since the separation between the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, between the two major political parties, Hamas and Fatah, we have seen a lot of cases of people that have been arrested and detained without clear charges and have not been given due process through being brought before the civil courts. Over 500 cases, 550 cases have been compiled during the first 10 months of 2009 from the northern part of the West Bank and the security agencies. They're justifying it with no good justification, if you wish.
So they're saying that there's a danger that Hamas might somehow
take over or control issues as what happened in Gaza Strip, and therefore they have to maintain public order.
And it's not just illegal detention that worries the commission. It's heard hundreds of allegations of torture from across the West Bank, and it's concerned about three deaths in custody. Security forces loyal to the West Bank's Fatah-backed government, the Palestinian Authority. They've done much to re-establish order in Nablus. Militants in the city have been persuaded to lay down their weapons, and there's been a move against gangsterism. But the allegations of the use of police state-style tactics hang in the air, and I put the reports of abuse in the city's jail to the commander in charge in Nablus, General Kher Ali. He alluded to problems but insisted they were in the past.
He says all of our orders is clear, not to hit anybody inside the jails. And if there is any small accidents happened here, we will solve it, and usually we solve it. Even if the one who do it is one of our soldiers, I think we are in the right way now. We don't have any political prisoners. All of them, they carry weapons or they did military issues and problems. So that's why we arrest all of them.
But the reports of abuse do undermine the Palestinian Authority's effort to portray itself as delivering good governance as it tries to build a de facto state in the West Bank. And there have been equally serious reports of mistreatment of Fatah supporters by Hamas in Gaza. Meanwhile, many Palestinians, like the city councillor Hafez Shaheen, look on in despair.
It is bringing the Palestinian case severely backwards. Palestinians should unify their forces towards solving the Palestinian case. Destroying the infrastructure of Hamas, who will benefit from that, is the Israelis. And destroying the infrastructure of Fatah in Gaza, who will benefit from that, is the Israeli occupation.
So the Hamas-Fatah dispute has implications way beyond party politics. Not only does it make it impossible for Palestinians to present a united front to Israel, the deep division in their camp makes it even more difficult for intermediaries to make any progress at all towards any kind of Middle East peace deal.
That report from the BBC's Alan Johnston in Nablus. Well, we have a couple of minutes now for your thoughts. Rose Oldux very much appreciated our conversation Tuesday about a Los Angeles Times report that found that many children adopted from China were not orphans as their American adoptive parents believed. Rose writes, "This problem is much broader than China. I'm an adoptive parent of two children from Latin America and Korea. An investigative news program from South Korea shows how young women there are coerced into surrendering their children because of their inability to pay the hospital bill for their child's delivery and the social stigma in South Korea of being an unwed mother. I did not know this. Thanks for your report." But John Deneen of Villanova, Pennsylvania, found the segment insensitive to the adopted children here in the U.S.
Now when someone sees that they're, you know, clearly because they're ethnically different, that they must be adopted children, that now also they're going to say, well, I wonder if they were abducted. To lay that on top of these people who have done nothing wrong and everything right and who are just only trying to be parents, I think is just really unfair.
Well, Alan Downing of Phoenix, Arizona, also contacted us after our segment on health care reform. Alan was responding to the suggestion from columnist David Leonhardt of the New York Times that hospitals with a high number of patients with preventable infections be paid less by Medicare to treat those infections as a way of getting hospitals to cut down on infections. Alan had a simple surgery and then was diagnosed with MRSA, an infection resistant to most antibiotics. He writes, "To make a long story short, my insurance company wouldn't pay for the medication my doctors wanted to prescribe because of the cost. As a result, I've now been hospitalized 3 times for treatment of my MRSA infection. The cost of the medication, Zyvox, would have probably been 2 orders of magnitude less than the cost of the 3 hospitalizations, which the insurance company did pay. Go figure." We'd love to hear your thoughts. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or make a phone call, or scroll down and leave a comment, or find us on Twitter at Here and Now. We'll be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back. Imagine the Faustian bargain in the hands of 5 teenagers. Brother and sister authors Daniel and Dina Nayeri have done just that in another Faust, their rewrite of Goethe's classic. In their version, 5 ambitious kids who want it all are kidnapped in Europe by a governess who's the devil incarnate. She gives them magical gifts to help them achieve their individual goals, moths that will spy for one or the ability to go back in time for another. In return, she gets their souls and sends them them to the Marlowe School, an elite prep school in Manhattan. Three of the five are aware of the bargain. The others have been implanted with false memories. Another Faust has elements of Harry Potter, Twilight, and Gossip Girl. And the brother and sister writing team of Daniel and Dina Nayeri join us with more. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you.
And Dina, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Why start with Kids Who Want Everything?
Dina and I can relate to being, both of us being extremely ambitious when we came to the States. We sort of had this immediate hit the ground running type of drive.
Came to the States from Iran.
Yes. Yeah.
There's that immigrant push, perhaps, to succeed. I'm wondering, too, we want to talk more about that, but are you also seeing, you know, maybe kids in America that are overindulged? Is there something else that you're saying there?
Well, I wouldn't say overindulged. I think, I mean, when you look at studies and in general reports on the college admissions situation, especially at the highest levels, you are finding kids who are being driven more and more into more extracurricular activities, programs, and things like that. So,
yeah. You know, I still do interviews for the admissions offices at Princeton and Harvard, and one of the things I noticed is that it takes a completely different set of activities and skills and you know, to get into colleges today than it did 10 years ago. I think kids are being driven by their parents more and by themselves.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, that you still do interviews for these Ivy League schools, because as these five teenagers in your fiction go to this elite prep school in New York City, we soon learn that, you know, you don't think that you have to have a Faustian governess to be pushed like that. You have regular parents in the school. You're both nodding, who are pushing like that. Does that come from your experience, you know, interviewing and meeting parents at Ivy League schools?
Well, I definitely met a lot of parents who push their kids too hard. Obviously, there's a spectrum, and it's really hard to kind of judge what is enough pushing and what is too much pushing. And we definitely have parents in our book that push their kids too much, but this is the extreme, and we wanted to present the extreme.
Well, and to offset the kids, Dana, you've got Biche. She's the only one of the five teenagers who does not make a deal with the devil. She's tricked to being involved with the governess, and so she has this special gift, unlimited time, but she uses it to learn languages. She's almost too good to be true. Now, who is she in this all for you?
Well, I think Dina and I, when we left Iran, we ended up traveling quite a bit. We were refugees, and so we were applying for asylum. And we landed in UAE, and then afterward Rome, and then finally the U.S. So I think both of us have had the experience of landing somewhere and wanting desperately to learn languages and be able to communicate. And so for us, learning languages has always been this extremely worthy goal, and I guess we wanted to give that to her.
It was very important to show the difference between accolades and accomplishments. And so this was somebody who has genuine goals and real accomplishments that she is striving for.
Well, so we understand you're looking to take this into a series, and you've already written another Pan set in the same elite prep school in New York. What would it be? Just boys who don't want to grow up?
Well, I mean, another Pan, sort of like the Faustian bargain being the central concept of the first, the second will be the Pan complex. So yes, we follow a different set of characters, but still in the Marlowe school, one of them an RA who obviously is obsessed with stopping time or stopping growth for himself. So
an RA, a resident assistant?
Yes, it's, yes. Well, Marlowe has a sort of a boarding school aspect.
Being a resident advisor, I think he gets the opportunity to then have all these lost boys, quote unquote, who are people who live there and don't necessarily have their parents around. So,
oh, yeah, that works well.
Yeah.
What other books are you thinking of putting in the same kind of another series?
The third one is most likely going to be Jekyll and Hyde. I think the idea for the whole thing was to have this school that is this place where all of these literary characters come together and kind of take on new life in a modern world. So you might look in one corner of the school and you have, you know, the modern day Peter Pan, and in another corner you have the modern day maybe Jane Eyre, and in another corner you have the modern day Fausts. Each book focuses on a different part.
Right.
Well, but here's a question. You know, some would say, gee, you know, what a shame they're not reading the real Faust or the real Jane Eyre or the real Jekyll and Hyde. Do you have to throw a prep school and magic into anything now to get kids to read it?
For us, by naming it another Faust, we were hoping that it would be a signpost. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, we hope that the series can be a gateway drug into the classics. If these popular elements do sort of entice a young reader, then they know exactly where the central concept came from, and they can go find that as well.
Well, meanwhile, as we mentioned, your brother and sister, and there's a lot of sibling rivalry in the book. You seem to know a thing or two about that. And in fact, there's a YouTube video of you guys in a writing session arguing. Let's just listen.
Okay, will you promise not to interrupt? in like gesture or words?
No gestures, no words. I swear to like breathe silently. What do you want?
Oh, you're not letting me talk.
You're insane.
Doesn't this get hard as brother and sister to work together? Or do you work it out by putting it in your characters when you're mad at each other?
Well, I think it definitely does get hard. I mean, we have very, very different voices, very different creative sensibilities. But I think we've really learned to figure out each other's...
Hot buttons?
Well, no, not hot buttons. We learned to avoid the hot buttons and to figure out how the other one functions so that we can move forward.
Well, we mentioned that, you know, you're doing more books and you're on tour with a competition to go along with the tour. And what are you asking of students?
Well, it's called Another Faust. The contest is to have them write sort of a short story that they submit. And then, of course, there's all kinds of prizes on our website. But basically, the idea is to begin their conversation with works that I guess they might think are dead and dusty.
And what have you heard?
We've had a lot of them react to the idea because some of them are eighth graders, and a lot of them it's suddenly the light has gone off when they realize that the story that they all read, Flowers for Algernon, does have sort of a Faustian bargain in it. Which it doesn't involve pitchforks and magic and supernatural powers, but it does involve a person who does have an excessive desire for something that he thinks is ultimate. He sort of gives himself over to this experimental drug and loses himself in something that he thinks is going to help him.
So that
metaphorical or symbolic, whatever.
So they're seeing something that they're reading
right.
as being Faustian, which they might not have even put that word to it before.
Exactly.
So I wonder, too, being Iranian, being immigrants and exiles in the U.S., did kids ask you about that, Daniel?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, we actually start the sort of presentation with showing them all the books that are banned in Iran and the books that we couldn't read. And it's always surprising for them to see, like, Huckleberry Finn on the list. And when we ask them, why do you think this is been banned, a lot of them always say, well, is it the racism? And we say, well, that's not so much the issue. In fact, it's a young man running around questioning authority. So that kind of gets them into the mindset of what it's like to live there.
And is there a second part of that, which is kind of like, gee, you know, I was thinking, oh, books, what? But they weren't even allowed to read books, so maybe
exactly.
I'll pay more attention.
Well, we actually start with that. You know, we talk about how, you know, when we were growing up, we had a very specific and restricted set of books that we were allowed to read. And if you were caught with some of the books that were on this list that we show them, you know, you actually could get in a lot of trouble. And then we, you know, talk about their libraries and how they should, you know, appreciate the books that they have all around.
So how do you know if so many books were banned? You're both very young. You don't look like you're out of your 20s. So when did you catch up on all these books that you talk about now, Faust and Peter Pan? And
in
well,
that's
middle
a good
school?
Question. Yeah, in middle school. When we came, we didn't really speak much English at all. So the way we were learning was that we would end up going to the library and picking out. And the reason we were picking out what the classics were because we understood them culturally. The newer things, like the Babysitter's Club, we didn't quite respond to because we didn't understand the culture yet. As a result, we sort of ended up using those to learn.
The Western canon.
The Western canon, yeah.
Yeah. That's Daniel and Dina Nayeri. They are sibling authors of Another Faust, the first installment of their Another series, retakes on classic books. Dina, Daniel, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having us.
Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.